Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 5 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5. The Watercress Bed. Bernard's practice, like most others, was subject to those fluctuations that filled the struggling practitioner alternately with hope and despair. The work came in paroxysms with intervals of almost complete stagnation. One of these intermissions occurred on the day after my visit to Neville's court, with the result that by 11:30 I found myself wondering what I should do with the remainder of the day. The better to consider this weighty problem, I strolled down to the embankment and, leaning on the parapet, contemplated the view across the river, the gray stone bridge with its perspective of arches, the picturesque pile of the shot towers, and beyond the shadowy shapes of the Abbey and St. Stephen's. It was a pleasant scene, restful and quiet, with a touch of life and a hint of sober romance, when a barge swept down through the middle arch of the bridge with a lug sail hoisted to a jury-mast and a white-aproned woman at the tiller. Dreamily I watched the craft creep by upon the moving tide, noted the low freeboard, almost awash, the careful helmswoman, and the dog on the forecastle yapping at the distant shore, and thought of Ruth Bellingham. What was there about this strange girl that had made so deep an impression on me? That was the question that I propounded to myself, and not for the first time. Of the fact itself there was no doubt, but what was the explanation? Was it her unusual surroundings, her occupation and rather recondite learning, her striking personality and exceptional good looks, or her connection with the dramatic mystery of her lost uncle? I concluded that it was all of these. Everything connected with her was unusual and arresting, but over and above these circumstances there was a certain sympathy and personal affinity, of which I was strongly conscious and of which I dimly hoped that she perhaps was a little conscious too. At any rate, I was deeply interested in her. Of that there was no doubt whatever. Short as our acquaintance had been, she held a place in my thoughts that had never been held by any other woman. From Ruth Bellingham my reflections passed by a natural transition to the curious story that her father had told me. It was a queer affair, that ill-drawn will, with the baffled lawyer protesting in the background. It almost seemed as if there must be something behind it all, especially when I remembered Mr. Hurst's very singular proposal. But it was out of my depth. It was a case for a lawyer, and to a lawyer it should go. This very night I resolved I would go to Thorndyke and give him the whole story as it had been told to me. And then there happened one of those coincidences at which we all wonder when they occur, but which are so frequent as to have become enshrined in a proverb. For even as I formed the resolution, I observed two men approaching from the direction of Blackfriars, and recognized in them my quondam teacher and his junior. "I was just thinking about you," I said as they came up. "Very flattering," replied Jervis, "but I thought you had to talk of the devil." "Perhaps," suggested Thorndyke, "he was talking to himself. But why were you thinking of us, and what was the nature of your thoughts?" "My thoughts had reference to the Bellingham case. I spent the whole of last evening at Neville's court." "Ha! Are there any fresh developments?" "Yes, by Jove, there are. Bellingham gave me a full detailed description of the will, and a pretty document it seems to be." "Did he give you permission to repeat the details to me?" "Yes, I asked specifically if I might, and he had no objection whatever." "Good. We are lunching at Soho today as Poulton has his hands full. Come with us and share our table and tell us your story as we go. Will that suit you? It suited me admirably in the present state of the practice, and I accepted the invitation with undissembled glee. Very well, said Thorndyke. Then let us walk slowly and finish with matters confidential before we plunge into the maddening crowd. We set forth at a leisurely pace along the broad pavement, and I commenced my narration. As well as I could remember, I related the circumstances that had led up to the present disposition of the property, and then proceeded to the actual provisions of the will, to all of which my two friends listened with rapt interest, Thorndyke occasionally stopping me to jot down a memorandum in his pocket-book. "Why, the fellow must have been stark lunatic," Jervis exclaimed, when I had finished. "He seems to have laid himself out with the most devilish ingenuity to defeat his own ends." "That is not an uncommon peculiarity with testators," Thorndyke remarked. "A direct and perfectly intelligible will is rather the exception. But we can hardly judge until we have seen the actual document. I suppose Bellingham hasn't a copy?" "I don't know," said I, "but I will ask him." "If he has one, I should like to look through it," said Thorndyke. "The provisions are very peculiar, and as Jervis says, admirably calculated to defeat the testator's wishes if they had been correctly reported. And apart from that, they have a remarkable bearing on the circumstances of the disappearance. I dare say you noticed that." "I noticed that it is very much to Hearst's advantage that the body has not been found." "Yes, of course, but there are some other points that are very significant. However, it would be premature to discuss the terms of the will until we have seen the actual document or a certified copy." "If there is a copy extant," I said, "I will try to get hold of it. But Bellingham is terribly afraid of being suspected of a desire to get professional advice gratis." "That," said Thorndyke, "is natural enough and not discreditable. But you must overcome his scruples somehow. I expect you will be able to. You are a plausible young gentleman, as I remember of old, and you seem to have established yourself as quite the friend of the family." "They are rather interesting people," I explained, "very cultivated and with a strong leaning towards archaeology. It seems to be in the blood." "Yes," said Thorndyke, "a family tendency, probably due to contact and common surroundings rather than heredity. So you like Godfrey Bellingham?" "Yes, he is a trifle peppery and impulsive, but quite an agreeable, genial old buffer." "And the daughter," said Jervis, "what is she like?" "Oh, she is a learned lady, works up bibliographies and references at the museum." "Ah," Jervis exclaimed with disfavor, "I know the breed. Inky fingers, no chest to speak of, all side and spectacles." I rose artlessly at the gross and palpable bait. "You're quite wrong," I exclaimed indignantly, contrasting Jervis's hideous presentment with the comely original. "She is an exceedingly good-looking girl, and her manners all that a lady should be. A little stiff, perhaps, but then I am only an acquaintance, almost a stranger." "But," Jervis persisted, "what is she like, in appearance, I mean? Short, fat, sandy? Give us intelligible details." I made a rapid mental inventory, assisted by my recent cogitations. "She is about 5'7", slim but rather plump, very erect in carriage and graceful in movements, black hair loosely parted in the middle and falling very prettily away from the forehead, pale, clear complexion, dark gray eyes, straight eyebrows, straight, well-shaped nose, short mouth, rather full, round chin. What the deuce are you grinning at, Jervis?" For my friend had suddenly unmasked his batteries and now threatened, like the Cheshire Cat, to dissolve into a mere abstraction of amusement. "If there is a copy of that will, Thorndyke," he said, "we shall get it. I think you agree with me, Reverend Senior?" "I have already said," was the reply, "that I put my trust in Berkeley. And now let us dismiss professional topics. This is our hostelry." He pushed open an unpretentious glazed door, and we followed him into the restaurant, whereof the atmosphere was pervaded by an appetizing meatiness mingled with less agreeable suggestions of the destructive distillation of fat. It was some 2 hours later when I wished my friends adieu under the golden-leaved plane trees of King's Bench Walk. "I won't ask you to come in now," said Thorndyke, "as we have some consultations this afternoon. But come in and see us soon. Don't wait for that copy of the will." "No," said Jervis. "Drop in the evening when your work is done. unless, of course, there is more attractive society elsewhere. Oh, you needn't turn that color, my dear child. We have all been young once. There is even a tradition that Thorndyke was young sometime back in the pre-dynastic period. Don't take any notice of him, Berkeley, said Thorndyke. The eggshell is sticking to his head still. He'll know better when he is my age. Methuselah! Exclaimed Jervis. I hope I shan't have to wait as long as that. Thorndyke smiled benevolently at his irrepressible junior, and shaking my hand cordially, turned into the entry. From the temple I wended northward, to the adjacent College of Surgeons, where I spent a couple of profitable hours examining the pickles and refreshing my memory on the subjects of pathology and anatomy, marveling afresh, as every practical anatomist must marvel, at the incredibly perfect technique of the dissections, and inwardly paying tribute to the founder of the collection. At length the warning of the clock, combined with an increasing craving for tea, drove me forth and bore me toward the scene of my not very strenuous labors. My mind was still occupied with the contents of the cases and the great glass jars, so that I found myself at the corner of Fetter Lane without a very clear idea of how I had got there. But at that point I was aroused from my reflections rather abruptly by a raucous voice in my ear.
"Horrible discovery at Sidcup!"
I turned wrathfully, for a London street boy's yell, let off at point-blank range, is in effect like the smack of an open hand. But the inscription on the staring yellow poster that was held up for my inspection changed my anger to curiosity.
Horrible discovery in a watercress bed!
Now let prigs deny it if they will, but there is something very attractive in a horrible discovery. It hints at tragedy, at mystery, at romance. It promises to bring into our gray and commonplace life that element of the dramatic which is the salt that our existence is savored withal.
In a watercress bed, too!
The rusticity of the background seemed to emphasize the horror of the discovery, whatever it might be. I bought a copy of the paper, and tucking it under my arm, hurried on to the surgery, promising myself a mental feast of watercress, but as I opened the door I found myself confronted by a corpulent woman of piebald and pimply aspect, who saluted me with a deep groan. It was the lady from the coal shop in Fleur-de-Lis Court.
"Good evening, Mrs. Jablett," I said briskly. "Not come about yourself, I hope?"
"Yes, I have," she answered, rising and following me gloomily into the consulting room. And then, when I had seated her in the patient's chair and myself at the writing table, she continued, "It's my inside, you know, doctor." The statement lacked anatomical precision and merely excluded the domain of the skin specialist. I accordingly waited for enlightenment and speculated on the watercress beds, while Mrs. Jablett regarded me expectantly with a dim and watery eye.
"Ah," I said at length, "it's your inside, is it, Mrs. Jablett?"
"Yes, and my head," she added, with a voluminous sigh that filled the apartment with odorous reminiscences of unsweetened.
"Your head aches, does it?"
"Something chronic," said Mrs. Jablett. "Feels as if it was a opening and a shutting, a opening and a shutting, and when I sit down I feel as if I should bust." This picturesque description of her sensations, not wholly inconsistent with her figure, gave the clue to Mrs. Jablett's sufferings. Resisting a frivolous impulse to reassure her as to the elasticity of the human integument, I considered her case in exhaustive detail, coasting delicately round the subject of unsweetened, and finally sent her away, revived in spirits and grasping a bottle of mist soda cum bithumo from Barnard's big stock jar. Then I went back to investigate the horrible discovery, but before I could open the paper, another patient arrived, impetigo contagiosa this time, affecting the wide and arch front sublime of a juvenile Fetter Laner, and then yet another, and so on through the evening until at last I forgot the watercress beds altogether. It was only when I had purified myself from the evening consultations with hot water and a nail brush, and was about to sit down to a frugal supper, that I remembered the newspaper and fetched it from the drawer of the consulting room table, where it had been hastily thrust out of sight. I folded it into a convenient form, and standing it upright against the water jug, read the report at my ease as I supped. There was plenty of it. Evidently the reporter had regarded it as a scoop, and the editor had backed him up with ample space and hair-raising headlines.
"Horrible discovery in a watercress bed at Sidcup."
A startling discovery was made yesterday afternoon in the course of clearing out a watercress bed near the erstwhile rural village of Sidcup in Kent, a discovery that will occasion many a disagreeable qualm to those persons who have been in the habit of regaling themselves with this refreshing esculent. But before proceeding to a description of the circumstances of the actual discovery or of the objects found, which, however it may be stated at once, are nothing more or less than the fragments of a dismembered human body, it will be interesting to trace the remarkable chain of coincidences by virtue of which the discovery was made. The beds in question have been laid out in a small artificial lake, fed by a tiny streamlet which forms one of the numerous tributaries of the River Cray. Its depth is greater than usual in the watercress beds, otherwise the gruesome relics could never have been concealed beneath its surface, and the flow of water through it, though continuous, is slow. The tributary streamlet meanders through a succession of pasture meadows, in one of which the beds themselves are situated, and here, throughout most of the year, the fleecy victims of the human carnivore carry on the industry of converting grass into mutton. Now it happened some years ago that the sheep frequenting these pastures became affected with the disease known as liver rot, and here we must make a short digression into the domain of pathology. Liver rot is a disease of quite romantic antecedents. Its cause is a small flat worm, the liver fluke, which infests the liver and bile ducts of the affected sheep. Now, how does the worm get into the sheep's liver? That is where the romance comes in. Let us see. The cycle of transformation begins with the deposit of the eggs of the fluke in some shallow stream or ditch running through pasture lands. Now, each egg has a sort of lid, which presently opens and lets out a minute, hairy creature who swims away in search of a particular kind of water snail, the kind called by naturalists Limnaea truncatula. If he finds a snail, he bores his way into its flesh and soon begins to grow and wax fat. Then he brings forth a family of tiny worms quite unlike himself, little creatures called rediae, which soon give birth to families of young rediae. So they go on for several generations, but at last there comes a generation of rediae which, instead of giving birth to fresh rediae, produce families of totally different offspring, big-headed, long-tailed creatures like miniature tadpoles, called by the learned carcharia. The carcharia soon wriggle their way out of the body of the snail, and then complications arise, for it is the habit of this particular snail to leave the water occasionally and take a stroll in the fields. Thus the carcharia, escaping from the snail, find themselves on the grass, whereupon they promptly drop their tails and stick themselves to the grass blades. Then comes the unsuspecting sheep to take his frugal meal, and cropping the grass swallows it, carcharia and all. But the latter, when they find themselves in the sheep's stomach, make their way straight to the bile ducts, up which they travel to the liver. Here, in a few weeks, they grow up into full-blown flukes and begin the important business of producing eggs. Such is the pathological romance of the liver rot. And now, what is its connection with this mysterious discovery? It is this. After the outbreak of liver rot above referred to, the ground landlord, a Mr. John Bellingham, instructed his solicitor to insert a clause in the lease of the beds directing that the latter should be periodically cleared and examined by an expert to make sure that they were free from these noxious water snails. The last lease expired about 2 years ago, and since then the beds have been out of cultivation, but for the safety of the adjacent pastures it was considered necessary to make the customary periodical inspection, and it was in the course of cleaning the beds for this purpose that the present discovery was made. The operation began 2 days ago. A gang of three men proceeded systematically to grub up the plants and collect the multitudes of water snails that they might be examined by the expert to see if any obnoxious species were present. They had cleared nearly half of the beds when, yesterday afternoon, one of the men working in the deepest part came upon some bones, the appearance of which excited his suspicion. Thereupon he called his mates, and they carefully picked away the plants piecemeal, a process that soon laid bare an unmistakable human hand lying on the mud amongst the roots. Fortunately, they had the wisdom not to disturb the remains, but at once sent off a message to the police. Very soon an inspector and a sergeant, accompanied by the divisional surgeon, arrived on the scene and were able to view the remains lying as they had been found. And now another very strange fact came to light.
for it was seen that the hand, the left one, lying on the mud was minus its third finger. This is regarded by the police as a very important fact as bearing on the question of identification, seeing that the number of persons having the third finger of the left hand missing must be quite small. After a thorough examination on the spot, the bones were carefully collected and conveyed to the mortuary, where they now lie awaiting further inquiries. The divisional surgeon, Dr. Brandon, in an interview with our representative, made the following statements. The bones are those of the left arm of a middle-aged or elderly man about 5 feet 8 inches in height. All the bones of the arm are present, including the scapula, or shoulder blade, and the clavicle, or collarbone, but the three bones of the third finger are missing. Is this a deformity, or has the finger been cut off? Our correspondent asked. The finger has been amputated, was the reply. If it had been absent from birth, the corresponding hand bone, or metacarpal, would have been wanting or deformed, whereas it is present and quite normal. How long have the bones been in the water? Was the next question. More than a year, I should say. They are quite clean. There is not a vestige of the soft structures left. Have you any theory as to how the arm came to be deposited where it was found? I should rather not answer that question, was the guarded response. One more question, our correspondent urged. The ground landlord, Mr. John Bellingham, is he not the gentleman who disappeared so mysteriously some time ago? So I understand, Dr. Brandon replied. Can you tell me if Mr. Bellingham had lost the third finger of his left hand? I cannot say, said Dr. Brandon, and he added with a smile, you had better ask the police. That is how the matter stands at present, but we understand that the police are making active inquiries for any missing man who has lost the third finger of his left hand, and if any of our readers know of such a person, they are earnestly requested to communicate at once either with us or the authorities. Also, we believe that a systematic search is to be made for further remains. I laid the newspaper down and fell into a train of reflection. It was certainly a most mysterious affair. The thought that had evidently come to the reporter's mind stole naturally into mine. Could these remains be those of John Bellingham? It was obviously possible, though I could not but see that the fact of the bones having been found on his land, while it undoubtedly furnished the suggestion, did not in any way add to its probability. The connection was accidental and in no wise relevant. Then, too, there was the missing finger. No reference to any such deformity had been made in the original report of the disappearance, though it could hardly have been overlooked. But it was useless to speculate without facts. I should be seeing Thorndyke in the course of the next few days, and undoubtedly, if the discovery had any bearing upon the disappearance of John Bellingham, I should hear of it. With such a reflection, I rose from the table, and adopting the advice contained in the spurious Johnsonian quotation, proceeded to take a walk in Fleet Street before settling down for the evening. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 6. Sidelights. The association of coal with potatoes is one upon which I have frequently speculated, without arriving at any more satisfactory explanation than that both products are of the earth, earthy. Of the connection itself, Barnard's practice furnished several instances besides Mrs. Jablett's establishment in Fleur-de-Lis Court, one of which was a dark and mysterious cavern a foot below the level of the street, that burrowed under an ancient house on the west side of Fetter Lane, a crinkly timber house of the three-decker type, that leaned back drunkenly from the road as if about to sit down in its own backyard. Passing this repository of the associated products about 10 o'clock in the morning, I perceived in the shadows of the cavern no less a person than Miss Omen. She saw me at the same moment and beckoned peremptorily with a hand that held the large Spanish onion. I approached with a deferential smile. "What a magnificent onion, Miss Omen! And how generous of you to offer it to me!" "I wasn't offering it to you. But there, isn't it just like a man?" "Isn't what just like a man?" I interrupted. "If you mean the onion—" "I don't," she snapped, "and I wish you wouldn't talk such a parcel of nonsense. a grown man and a member of a serious profession, too. You ought to know better.
I suppose I ought, I said reflectively, and she continued, I called in at the surgery just now.
To see me?
What else should I come for? Do you suppose that I called to consult the bottle boy?
Certainly not, Miss Oman.
So you find the lady doctor no use after all?
Miss Oman gnashed her teeth at me, and very fine teeth they were, too.
I called, she said majestically, on behalf of Miss Bellingham. My facetiousness evaporated instantly. I hope Miss Bellingham is not ill, I said, with a sudden anxiety that elicited a sardonic smile from Miss Oman.
No, was the reply, she is not ill, but she has cut her hand rather badly. It's her right hand, too, and she can't afford to lose the use of it, not being a great, bulky, lazy, lolloping man. So you had better go and put some stuff on it.
With this advice, Miss Oman whisked to the right about and vanished into the depths of the cavern like the Witch of Woki, while I hurried on to the surgery to provide myself with the necessary instruments and materials, and thence proceeded to Neville's court. Miss Oman's juvenile maidservant, who opened the door to me, stated the existing conditions with epigrammatic conciseness.
Mr. Bellingham is out, sir, but Miss Bellingham is hin.
Having thus delivered herself, she retreated toward the kitchen, and I ascended the stairs, at the head of which I found Miss Bellingham awaiting me with her right hand encased in what looked like a white boxing glove.
"I'm glad you have come," she said. "Phyllis, Miss Oman, you know, has kindly bound up my hand, but I should like you to see that it is all right."
We went into the sitting-room, where I laid out my paraphernalia on the table, while I inquired into the particulars of the accident. "It is most unfortunate that it should have happened just now," she said, as I wrestled with one of those remarkable feminine knots that, while they seem to defy the utmost efforts of human ingenuity to untie, yet have a singular habit of untying themselves at inopportune moments.
"Why just now in particular?" I asked.
"Because I have some specially important work to do. A very learned lady who is writing an historical book has commissioned me to collect all the literature relating to the Tel el Amarna letters, the cuneiform tablets, you know, of Amenhotep IV.
"Well," I said soothingly, "I expect your hand will soon be well."
"Yes, but that won't do. The work has to be done immediately. I have to send in completed notes not later than this day week, and it will be quite impossible. I am dreadfully disappointed."
By this time I had unwound the voluminous wrappings and exposed the injury, a deep gash in the palm that must have narrowly missed a good-sized artery. Obviously the hand would be useless for fully a week.
"I suppose," she said, "you couldn't patch it up so that I could write with it?"
I shook my head.
"No, Miss Bellingham, I shall have to put it on a splint. We can't run any risks with a deep wound like this."
"Then I shall have to give up the commission, and I don't know how my client will get the work done in time. You see, I am pretty well up in the literature of ancient Egypt. In fact, I was to receive special payment on that account, and it would have been such an interesting task, too. However, it can't be helped."
I proceeded methodically with the application of the dressings, and meanwhile reflected. It was evident that she was deeply disappointed. Loss of work meant loss of money, and it needed but a glance at her rusty black dress to see that there was little margin for that. Possibly, too, there was some special need to be met. Her manner seemed almost to imply that there was, and at this point I had a brilliant idea.
"I'm not sure that it can't be helped," said I.
She looked at me inquiringly, and I continued, "I am going to make a proposition, and I shall ask you to consider it with an open mind."
"That sounds rather portentous," said she, "but I promise. What is it?"
"It is this. When I was a student, I acquired the useful art of writing shorthand. I am not a lightning reporter, you understand, but I can take matter down from dictation at quite respectable speed."
"Yes?"
"Well, I have several hours free every day, usually the whole afternoon up to 6 or 5:30, and it occurs to me that if you were to go to the museum in the mornings, you could get out your books, look up passages, you could do that without using your right hand, and put in bookmarks. Then I could come along in the afternoon and you could read out the selected passages to me, and I could take them down in shorthand. We should get through as much in a couple of hours as you could in a day using longhand."
"Oh, but how kind of you, Dr. Berkeley," she exclaimed. "How very kind! Of course, I couldn't think of taking up all your leisure in that way, but I do appreciate your kindness very much." I was rather chapfallen at this very definite refusal, but persisted feebly. "I wish you would. It may seem rather a cheek for a comparative stranger like me to make such a proposal to a lady, but if you'd been a man in those special circumstances, I should have made it all the same, and you would have accepted as a matter of course." "I doubt that. At any rate, I am not a man. I sometimes wish I were." "Oh, I am sure you are much better as you are," I exclaimed, with such earnestness that we both laughed. And at this moment Mr. Bellingham entered the room carrying several large brand-new books in a strap. "Well, I'm sure," he exclaimed genially, "here are pretty goings-on. Doctor and patient giggling like a pair of schoolgirls. What's the joke?" He thumped his parcel of books down on the table and listened smilingly while my unconscious witticism was expounded. "The doctor's quite right," he said. "You'll do as you are, Chick, but the Lord knows what sort of man you would make. You take his advice and let well alone." Finding him in this genial frame of mind, I ventured to explain my proposition to him and to enlist his support. He considered it with attentive approval, and when I had finished, turned to his daughter. "What is your objection, Chick?" he asked. "It would give Dr. Berkeley such a fearful lot of work," she answered. "It would give him a fearful lot of pleasure," I said. "It would, really." "Then why not?" said Mr. Bellingham. "We don't mind being under an obligation to the doctor, do we?" "Oh, it isn't that," she exclaimed hastily. "Then take him at his word. He means it. It is a kind action, and he'll like doing it, I'm sure." "That's all right, doctor. She accepts, don't you, Chick?" "Yes, if you say so, I do, and most thankfully." She accompanied the acceptance with a gracious smile that was in itself a large repayment on account, and when we made the necessary arrangements, I hurried away in a state of the most perfect satisfaction to finish my morning's work and order an early lunch. When I called for her a couple of hours later, I found her waiting in the garden with the shabby handbag, of which I relieved her, and we set forth together, watched jealously by Miss Omen, who had accompanied her to the gate. As I walked up the court with this wonderful maid by my side, I could hardly believe in my good fortune. By her presence and my own resulting happiness, the mean surroundings became glorified and the commonest objects transfigured into things of beauty. What a delightful thoroughfare, for instance, was Fetter Lane, with its quaint charm and medieval grace! I snuffed the cabbage-laden atmosphere and seemed to breathe the scent of the asphodel. Holborn was even as the Elysian fields. The omnibus that bore us westward was a chariot of glory, and the people who swarmed verminously on the pavements bore the semblance of the children of light. Love is a foolish thing, judged by workaday standards, and the thoughts and actions of lovers foolish beyond measure. But the workaday standard is the wrong one, after all, for the utilitarian mind does but busy itself with the trivial and transitory interests of life, behind which looms the great and everlasting reality of the love of man and woman. There is more significance in a nightingale's song in the hush of a summer night than in all the wisdom of Solomon, who, by the way, was not without his little experiences of the tender passion. The janitor in the little glass box by the entrance to the library inspected us and passed us on, with a silent benediction, to the lobby, whence, when I had handed my stick to a bald-headed demigod and received a talismanic disc in exchange, we entered the enormous rotunda of the reading-room. I have often thought that if some lethal vapor of highly preservative properties, such as formaldehyde, for instance, could be shed into the atmosphere of this apartment, the entire and complete collection of books and bookworms would be well worth preserving for the enlightenment of posterity, as a sort of anthropological appendix to the main collection of the museum. For surely nowhere else in the world are so many strange and abnormal human beings gathered together in one place. And a curious question that must have occurred to many observers is, whence do these singular creatures come, and whither do they go when the very distinct-faced clock, adjusted to literary eyesight, proclaims closing time? The tragic-faced gentleman, for instance, with the corkscrew ringlets that bob up and down like the spiral springs as he walks? Or the short elderly gentleman in the black cassock and bowler hat,
who shatters your nerves by turning suddenly and revealing himself as a middle-aged woman? Whither do they go? One never sees them elsewhere. Do they steal away at closing time into the depths of the museum and hide themselves until morning in sarcophagi or mummy cases? Or do they creep through spaces in the bookshelves and spend the night behind the volumes in a congenial atmosphere of leather and antique paper? Who can say? What I do know is that when Ruth Bellingham entered the reading room, she appeared in comparison with these like a creature of another order. Even as the head of Antinous, which formerly stood, and has since been moved, amidst the portrait busts of the Roman emperors, seemed like the head of a god set in a portrait gallery of illustrious baboons. "What have we got to do?" I asked when we had found a vacant seat. "Do you want to look up the catalogue?" "No, I have the tickets in my bag. The books are waiting in the kept books department." I placed my hat on the leather-covered shelf, dropped her gloves into it, how delightfully intimate and companionable it seemed, altered the numbers on the tickets, and then we proceeded together to the kept books desk to collect the volumes that contained the material for our day's work. It was a blissful afternoon. 2.5 hours of happiness unalloyed did I spend at that shiny leather-clad desk, guiding my nimble pen across the pages of the notebook. It introduced me to a new world, a world in which love and learning, sweet intimacy and crusted archaeology, were mingled into the oddest, most whimsical, and most delicious confection that the mind of man can conceive. Hitherto, these recondite histories had been far beyond my ken. Of the wonderful heretic, Amenhotep IV, I had already heard. At the most, he had been a mere name, the Hittites, a mythical race of undetermined habitat, while cuneiform tablets had presented themselves to my mind merely as an uncouth kind of fossil biscuit suited to the digestion of a prehistoric ostrich. Now all this was changed. As we sat with our chairs creaking together and she whispered the story of those stirring times into my receptive ear, talking is strictly forbidden in the reading room, the disjointed fragments arranged themselves into a romance of supreme fascination. Egyptian, Babylonian, Aramean, Hittite, Memphis, Babylon, Hamath, Megiddo. I swallowed them all thankfully, wrote them down, and asked for more. Only once did I disgrace myself. An elderly clergyman of ascetic and assiduous aspect had passed us with a glance of evident disapproval, clearly setting us down as intruding philanderers, and when I contrasted the parson's probable conception of the whispered communications that were being poured into my ear so tenderly and confidentially with the dry reality, I chuckled aloud. But my fair taskmistress only paused, with her finger on the page smilingly to rebuke me, and then went on with the dictation. She was certainly a Tartar for work. It was a proud moment for me when, in response to my interrogative, "Yes?" my companion said, "That is all," and closed the book. We had extracted the pith and marrow of 6 considerable volumes in 2.5 hours. "You have been better than your word," she said. "It would have taken me 2 full days of really hard work to make the notes that you have written down since we commenced. I don't know how to thank you." "There's no need to. I've enjoyed myself and polished up my shorthand. What is the next thing? We shall want some books for tomorrow, shan't we?" "Yes, I have made out a list, so if you will come with me to the catalogue desk, I will look up the numbers and ask you to write the tickets." The selection of a fresh batch of authorities occupied us for another quarter of an hour, and then, having handed in the volumes that we had squeezed dry, we took our way out of the reading room. "Which way shall we go?" she asked as we passed out of the gate, where stood a massive policeman, like the guardian angel at the gate of paradise, only thank heaven, he bore no flaming sword forbidding re-entry. "We are going," I replied, "to Museum Street, where is a milk-shop in which one can get an excellent cup of tea." She looked as if she would have demurred, but eventually followed obediently, and we were soon settled side by side at the little marble-topped table, retracing the ground we had covered in the afternoon's work and discussing various points of interest over a joint teapot. "Have you been doing this sort of work long?" I asked, as she handed me my second cup of tea. "Professionally," she answered, "only about 2 years, since we broke up our home, in fact. But long before that I used to come to the museum with my Uncle John, the one who disappeared, you know, in that dreadfully mysterious way, and helped him to look up references.
We were good friends, he and I.
I suppose he was a very learned man, I suggested.
Yes, in a certain way. In the way of the better-class collector, he was very learned indeed. He knew the contents of every museum in the world, insofar as they were connected with Egyptian antiquities, and had studied them specimen by specimen. Consequently, as Egyptology is largely a museum science, he was a learned Egyptologist. But his real interest was in things rather than events. Of course, he knew a great deal, a very great deal, about Egyptian history, but still he was, before all, a collector.
And what will happen to his collection if he is really dead?
The greater part of it goes to the British Museum by his will, and the remainder he has left to his solicitor, Mr. Jellicoe.
To Mr. Jellicoe? Why, what will Mr. Jellicoe do with Egyptian antiquities?
Oh, he is an Egyptologist, too, and quite an enthusiast. He has really a fine collection of scarabs and other small objects, such as it is possible to keep in a private house. I have always thought that it was his enthusiasm for everything Egyptian that brought him and my uncle together on terms of such intimacy, though I believe he is an excellent lawyer, and he is certainly a very discreet, cautious man.
Is he? I shouldn't have thought so, judging by your uncle's will.
Oh, but that is not Mr. Jellicoe's fault. He assures us that he entreated my uncle to let him draw up a fresh document with more reasonable provisions. But he says Uncle John was immovable, and he really was a rather obstinate man. Mr. Jellicoe repudiates any responsibility in the matter. He washes his hands of the whole affair and says that it is the will of a lunatic.
And so it is. I was glancing through it only a night or two ago, and really I cannot conceive how a sane man could have written such nonsense.
You have a copy, then? I asked eagerly, remembering Thorndyke's parting instructions.
Yes, would you like to see it? I know my father has told you about it, and it is worth reading as a curiosity of perverseness.
I should very much like to show it to my friend Dr. Thorndyke, I replied. He said he would be interested to read it and learn the exact provisions, and it might be well to let him and hear what he has to say about it.
I see no objection, she rejoined. But you know what my father is, his horror, I mean, of what he calls catching for advice gratis.
Oh, but he need have no scruples on that score. Dr. Thorndyke wants to see the will because the case interests him. He is an enthusiast, you know, and he put the request as a personal favor to himself.
That is very nice and delicate of him, and I will explain the position to my father. If he is willing for Dr. Thorndyke to see the copy, I will send or bring it over this evening. Have we finished?
I regretfully admitted that we had, and when I had paid the modest reckoning, we sallied forth, turning back with one accord into Great Russell Street to avoid the noise and bustle of the larger thoroughfares.
"What sort of a man was your uncle?" I asked presently, as we walked along the quiet, dignified street. And then I added hastily, "I hope you don't think me inquisitive, but to my mind he presents himself as a kind of mysterious abstraction, the unknown quantity of a legal problem."
My Uncle John, she answered reflectively, was a very peculiar man, rather obstinate, very self-willed, what people call masterful, and decidedly wrong-headed and unreasonable.
That is certainly the impression that the terms of his will convey, I said.
Yes, and not the will only. There was the absurd allowance that he made to my father. That was a ridiculous arrangement, and very unfair, too. He ought to have divided the property up as my grandfather intended. And yet he was by no means ungenerous, only he would have his own way, and his own way was very commonly the wrong way.
I remember, she continued after a short pause, a very odd instance of his wrong-headedness and obstinacy. It was a small matter, but very typical of him. He had in his collection a beautiful little ring of the 18th dynasty. It was said to have belonged to Queen Tai, the mother of our friend Amenhotep IV. But I don't think that could have been so, because a device on it was the Eye of Osiris, and Tai, as you know, was an Aten worshipper. However, it was a very charming ring, and Uncle John, who had a queer sort of devotion to the mystical Eye of Osiris, commissioned a very clever goldsmith to make two exact copies of it, one for himself and one for me. The goldsmith naturally wanted to take the measurements of our fingers, but this Uncle John would not hear of. The rings were to be exact copies, and an exact copy must be the same size as the original. You can imagine the result.
My ring was so loose that I couldn't keep it in my finger, and Uncle John's was so tight that though he did manage to get it on, he was never able to get it off. And it was only the circumstance that his left hand was decidedly smaller than his right that made it possible for him to wear it at all.
So you never wore your copy?
No, I wanted to have it altered to make it fit, but he objected strongly, so I put it away and have it in a box still.
He must have been an extraordinarily pig-headed old fellow, I remarked.
Yes, he was very tenacious. He annoyed my father a good deal, too, by making unnecessary alterations in the house in Queen Square when he fitted up his museum. We have a certain sentiment with regard to that house. Our people have lived in it ever since it was built, when the square was first laid out in the reign of Queen Anne, after whom it was named. It is a dear old house. Would you like to see it? We are quite near it now. I assented eagerly. If it had been a coal shed or a fried fish shop, I would still have visited it with pleasure, for the sake of prolonging our walk. But I was also really interested in this old house as a part of the background of the mystery of the vanished John Bellingham. We crossed into Cosmo Place, with its quaint row of the now rare cannon-shaped iron posts, and passing through stood for a few moments looking into the peaceful, stately old square. A party of boys disported themselves noisily on the range of stone posts that form a bodyguard round the ancient lamp-surmounted pump, but otherwise the place was wrapped in dignified repose suited to its age and station. And very pleasant it looked on this summer afternoon with the sunlight gilding the foliage of its wide-spreading plane trees and lighting up the warm-toned brick of the house fronts. We walked slowly down the shady west side, near the middle of which my companion halted.
"This is the house," she said. "It looks gloomy and forsaken now, but it must have been a delightful house in the days when my ancestors could look out of the windows through the open end of the square across the fields of meadows to the heights of Hampstead and Highgate." She stood at the edge of the pavement looking up with a curious wistfulness at the old house, a very pathetic figure, I thought, with her handsome face and proud carriage, her threadbare dress and shabby gloves, standing at the threshold of the home that had been her family's for generations, that should now have been hers, and that was shortly to pass away into the hands of strangers. I, too, looked up at it with a strange interest, impressed by something gloomy and forbidding in its aspect. The windows were shuttered from basement to attic, and no sign of life was visible. Silent, neglected, desolate, it breathed an air of tragedy. It seemed to mourn in sackcloth and ashes for its lost master. The massive door within the splendid carven portico was crusted with grime and seemed to have passed out of use as completely as the ancient lamp irons or the rusted extinguishers wherein the footmen were wont to quench their torches when some Bellingham dame was borne up the steps in her gilded chair in the days of good Queen Anne. It was in a somewhat sobered frame of mind that we presently turned away and started homeward by way of Great Ormond Street. My companion was deeply thoughtful, relapsing for a while into that somberness of manner that had so impressed me when I first met her. Nor was I without a certain sympathetic pensiveness, as if from the great silent house the spirit of the vanished man had issued forth to bear us company. But still it was a delightful walk, and I was sorry when at last we arrived at the entrance to Neville's Court, and Miss Bellingham halted and held out her hand. "Goodbye," she said, "and many, many thanks for your invaluable help. Shall I take the bag?"
"If you want it, but I must take out the notebooks."
"Why must you take them?" she asked.
"Why, haven't I got to copy the notes out in longhand?"
An expression of utter consternation spread over her face. In fact, she was so completely taken aback that she forgot to release my hand.
"Heavens!" she exclaimed. "How idiotic of me! But it is impossible, Dr. Berkeley. It will take you hours."
"It is perfectly possible, and it is going to be done. Otherwise the notes would be useless. Do you want the bag?"
"No, of course not. But I am positively appalled. Hadn't you better give up the idea?"
"And this is the end of our collaboration?" I exclaimed tragically, giving her hand a final squeeze, whereby she became suddenly aware of its position and withdrew it rather hastily.
"Would you throw away a whole afternoon's work?"
"I won't, certainly. So goodbye until tomorrow. I shall turn up in the reading room as early as I can. You had better take the tickets. Oh, and you won't forget about the copy of the will for Dr. Thorndyke, will you?"
No, if my father agrees, you shall have it this evening. She took the tickets from me, and, thanking me yet again, retired into the court. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 7. John Bellingham's Will. The task upon which I had embarked so light-heartedly, when considered in cold blood, did certainly appear, as Miss Bellingham had said, rather appalling. The result of 2.5 hours' pretty steady work and an average speed of nearly 100 words a minute would take some time to transcribe into longhand, and if the notes were to be delivered punctually on the morrow, the sooner I got to work the better. Recognizing this truth, I lost no time, but within 5 minutes of my arrival at the surgery, was seated at the writing-table with my copy before me, busily converting the sprawling, inexpressive characters into good, legible roundhand. The occupation was by no means unpleasant, apart from the fact that it was a labor of love, for the sentences, as I picked them up, were fragrant with the reminiscences of the gracious whisper in which they had first come to me. And then the matter itself was full of interest. I was gaining a fresh outlook on life, was crossing the threshold of a new world, which was her world, and so the occasional interruptions from the patients, while they gave me intervals of enforced rest, were far from welcome. The evening wore on without any sign from Neville's court, and I began to fear that Mr. Bellingham's scruples had proved insurmountable. Not, I am afraid, that I was so much concerned for the copy of the will as for the possibility of a visit, no matter howsoever brief, from my fair employer, and when, on the stroke of 7:30, the surgery door flew open with startling abruptness, my fears were allayed and my hopes shattered simultaneously. For it was Miss Oman who stalked in, holding out a blue foolscap envelope with a warlike air as if it were an ultimatum. "I've brought you this from Mr. Bellingham," she said. "There's a note inside." "May I read the note, Miss Oman?" I asked. "Bless the man," she exclaimed. "What else would you do with it? Isn't that what it's brought for?" I supposed it was, and thanking her for her gracious permission, I glanced through the note, a few lines authorizing me to show the copy of the will to Dr. Thorndyke. When I looked up from the paper, I found her eyes fixed on me with an expression critical and rather disapproving. "You seem to be making yourself mighty agreeable in a certain quarter," she remarked. "I make myself universally agreeable. It is my nature to." "Huh," she snorted. "Don't you find me rather agreeable?" I asked. "Oily," said Miss Oman, and then with a sour smile at the open notebook, she remarked, "You've got some work to do now, quite a change for you." "A delightful change, Miss Oman, for Satan findeth, but no doubt you are acquainted with the philosophical works of Dr. Watts." "If you are referring to idle hands," she replied, "I'll give you a bit of advice. Don't you keep that hand idle any longer than is really necessary. I have my suspicions about that splint. Oh, you know what I mean." And before I had time to reply, she had taken advantage of the entrance of a couple of patients to whisk out of the surgery with the abruptness that had distinguished her arrival. The evening consultations were considered to be over by 8:30, at which time Adolphus was wont with exemplary punctuality to close the outer door of the surgery. Tonight he was not less prompt than usual, and having performed this, his last daily office, and turned down the surgery gas, he reported the fact and took his departure. As his retreating footsteps died away, and the slamming of the outer door announced his final disappearance, I sat up and stretched myself. The envelope containing the copy of the will lay on the table, and I considered it thoughtfully. It ought to be conveyed to Thorndyke with as little delay as possible, and as it certainly could not be trusted out of my hands, it ought to be conveyed by me. I looked at the notebooks. Nearly 2 hours' work had made a considerable impression on the matter that I had to transcribe, but still a great deal of the task yet remained to be done. However, I reflected, I could put in a couple of hours or more before going to bed, and there would be an hour or two to spare in the morning. Finally, I locked the notebooks, open as they were, in the writing-table drawer, and slipping the envelope into my pocket, set out for the temple.
The soft chime of the treasury clock was telling out, in confidential tones, the third quarter, as I rapped with my stick on the forbidding oak of my friend's chambers. There was no response, nor had I perceived any gleam of light from the windows as I approached, and I was considering the advisability of trying the laboratory on the next floor, when footsteps on the stone stairs and familiar voices gladdened my ear. "Hello, Berkeley," said Thorndyke. "Do we find you waiting like a Peri at the gates of paradise? Holton is upstairs, you know, tinkering at one of his inventions. If you ever find the nest empty, you had better go up and bang at the laboratory door. He's always there in the evenings." "I haven't been waiting long," said I, "and I was just thinking of rousing him when you came." "That was right," said Thorndyke, turning up the gas. "And what news do you bring? Do I see a blue envelope sticking out of your pocket?"
"You do."
"Is it a copy of the will?" he asked. I answered yes, and added that I had full permission to show it to him.
"What did I tell you?" exclaimed Jervis. "Didn't I say that he would get the copy for us if it existed?"
"We admit the excellence of your prognosis," said Thorndyke, "but there is no need to be boastful. Have you read through the document, Berkeley?"
"No, I haven't taken it out of the envelope."
"Then it will be equally new to us all, and we shall see if it tallies with your description."
He placed three easy chairs at a convenient distance from the light, and Jervis, watching him with a smile, remarked, "Now Thorndyke is going to enjoy himself. To him, a perfectly unintelligible will is a thing of beauty and a joy forever, especially if associated with some kind of recondite knavery."
"I don't know," said I, "that this will is particularly unintelligible. The mischief seems to be that it is rather too intelligible. However, here it is," and I handed it over to Thorndyke.
"I suppose that we can depend on this copy," said the latter, as he drew out the document and glanced at it. "Oh, yes," he added, "I see it is copied by Godfrey Bellingham, compared with the original and certified correct. In that case, I will get you to read it out slowly, Jervis, and I will make a rough copy for reference. Let us make ourselves comfortable and light our pipes before we begin." He provided himself with a writing-pad, and when we had seated ourselves and got our pipes well alight, Jervis opened the document, and with a premonitory ahem, commenced the reading. "In the name of God, amen. This is the last will and testament of me, John Bellingham, of number 141 Queen Square in the parish of St. George, Bloomsbury, London, in the county of Middlesex, gentlemen, made this 21st day of September in the year of our Lord 1892. 1. I give and bequeath unto Arthur Jellicoe of number 184 New Square, Lincoln's Inn, London, in the county of Middlesex, attorney at law, the whole of my collection of seals and scarabs, and those in my cabinets marked A, B, and D, together with the contents thereof, and the sum of £2,000 sterling free of legacy duty. Unto the trustees of the British Museum the residue of my collection of antiquities. Unto my cousin George Hurst of the Poplars, Eltham, in the county of Kent, the sum of £5,000 free of legacy duty, and unto my brother Godfrey Bellingham, or if he should die before the occurrence of my death, unto his daughter Ruth Bellingham, the residue of my estate and effects real and personal subject to the conditions set forth hereinafter, namely, 2. That my body shall be deposited with those of my ancestors in the churchyard appertaining to the church and parish of St. George the Martyr, or, if that shall not be possible, in some other churchyard, cemetery, burial ground, church or chapel, or other authorized place for the reception of the bodies of the dead situate within or appertaining to the parishes of St. Andrew above the bars, and St. George the Martyr, or St. George Bloomsbury, and St. Giles in the fields. But if the conditions in this clause be not carried out, then 3. I give and devise the said residue of my estate and effects unto my cousin George Hurst aforesaid, and I hereby revoke all wills and codicils made by me at any time heretofore, and I appoint Arthur Jellicoe aforesaid to be the executor of this my will, jointly with the principal beneficiary and residuary legatee, that is to say, with the aforesaid Godfrey Bellingham, if the conditions set forth herein before in clause 2 shall be duly carried out, but with the aforesaid George Hurst, if the said conditions in the said clause 2 be not carried out. John Bellingham.
signed by the said testator John Bellingham in the presence of us, present at the same time, who at his request and in his presence, and in the presence of each other, have subscribed our names as witnesses. Frederick Wilton, 16 Medford Road, London North, Clerk. James Barber, 32 Wadbury Crescent, London Southwest, Clerk. "Well," said Jervis, laying down the document as Thorndyke detached the last sheet from his writing-pad, "I have met with a good many idiotic wills, but this one can give them all points. I don't see how it is ever going to be administered. One of the two executors is a mere abstraction, a sort of algebraical problem with no answer." "I think that difficulty could be overcome," said Thorndyke. "I don't see how," retorted Jervis. "If the body is deposited in a certain place, A is the executor. If it is somewhere else, B is the executor. But as you cannot produce the body, and no one has the least idea where it is impossible to prove either that it is or that it is not in any specific place." "You are magnifying the difficulty," Jervis said Thorndyke. "The body may, of course, be anywhere in the entire world, but the place where it is lying is either inside or outside the general boundary of those two parishes. If it has been deposited within the boundary of those two parishes, the fact must be ascertainable by examining the burial certificates issued since the date when the missing man was last seen alive, and by consulting the registers of those specific places of burial. I think that if no record can be found of any such interment within the boundary of those two parishes, that fact will be taken by the court as proof that no such interment has taken place, and that therefore the body must have been deposited somewhere else. Such a decision would constitute George Hurst the co-executor and residuary legatee." "That is cheerful for your friends, Berkeley," Jervis remarked, "for we may take it as pretty certain that the body has not been deposited in any of the places named." "Yes," I agreed gloomily, "I'm afraid there is very little doubt of that. But what an ass that fellow must have been to make such a to-do about his beastly carcass. What the deuce could it have mattered to him where it was dumped when he had done with it?" Thorndyke chuckled softly. "Thus the irreverent youth of today," said he. "But yours is hardly a fair comment, Berkeley. Our training makes us materialists and puts us a little out of sympathy with those in whom primitive beliefs and emotions survive. A worthy priest who came to look at our dissecting room expressed surprise to me that the students, thus constantly in the presence of relics of mortality, should be able to think of anything but the resurrection and the life hereafter. He was a bad psychologist. There is nothing so dead as a dissecting room subject, and the contemplation of the human body in the process of being quietly taken to pieces, being resolved into its structural units like a worn-out clock or an old engine in the scrapper's yard, is certainly not conducive to a vivid realization of the doctrine of the resurrection. No, but this absurd anxiety to be buried in some particular place has nothing to do with religious belief. It is merely silly sentiment." "It is sentiment, I admit," said Thorndyke, "but I wouldn't call it silly. The feeling is so widespread in time and space that we must look on it with respect to something inherent in human nature. Think, as doubtless John Bellingham did, of the ancient Egyptians, whose chief aspiration was that of everlasting repose for the dead. See the trouble they took to achieve it. Think of the Great Pyramid, or that of Amenhotep IV, with its labyrinth of false passages and its sealed and hidden sepulchral chambers. Think of Jacob, borne after death all those hundreds of weary miles in order that he might sleep with his fathers, and then remember Shakespeare in his solemn adjuration to posterity to let him rest undisturbed in his grave. No, Berkeley, it is not a silly sentiment. I am as indifferent as you as to what becomes of my body when I have done with it, to use your irreverent phrase, but I recognize the solicitude that some other men display on the subject as a natural feeling that has yet to be taken seriously." "But even so," I said, "if this man had a hankering for a freehold residence in some particular boneyard, he might have gone about the business in a more reasonable way." "There I am entirely with you," Thorndyke replied. "It is the absurd way in which this provision is worded that not only creates all the trouble, but also makes the whole document so curiously significant in view of the testator's disappearance." "How significant?" Jervis demanded eagerly. "Let us consider the provisions of the will point by point," said Thorndyke.
and first note that the testator commanded the services of a very capable lawyer.
But Mr. Jellicoe disapproved of the will, said I. In fact, he protested strongly against the form of it.
We will bear that in mind, too, Thorndyke replied. And now, with reference to what we may call the contentious clauses, the first thing that strikes us is their preposterous injustice. Godfrey's inheritance is made conditional on a particular disposal of the testator's body. But this is a matter not necessarily under Godfrey's control. The testator might have been lost at sea, or killed in a fire or explosion, or have died abroad and been buried where his grave could not have been identified. There are numerous probable contingencies besides the improbable one that has happened that might prevent the body from being recovered. But even if the body had been recovered, there is another difficulty. The places of burial in the parishes have all been closed for many years. It would be impossible to reopen any of them without a special faculty, and I doubt whether such a faculty would be granted. Possibly cremation might meet the difficulty, but even that is doubtful, and in any case the matter would not be in the control of Godfrey Bellingham. Yet if the required interment should prove impossible, he is to be deprived of his legacy.
It is a monstrous and absurd injustice, I exclaimed.
It is, Thorndyke agreed, but this is nothing to the absurdity that comes to light when we consider clauses 2 and 3 in detail. Observe that the testator presumably wished to be buried in a certain place. Also, he wished his brother should benefit under the will. Let us take the first point and see how he has set about securing the accomplishment of what he desired. Now, if we read clauses 2 and 3 carefully, we shall see that he has rendered it virtually impossible that his wishes can be carried out. He desires to be buried in a certain place and makes Godfrey responsible for his being so buried. But he gives Godfrey no power or authority to carry out the provision, and places insuperable obstacles in his way. For until Godfrey is an executor, he has no power or authority to carry out the provision, and until the provisions are carried out, he does not become an executor.
It is a preposterous muddle, exclaimed Jervis.
Yes, but that is not the worst of it, Thorndyke continued. The moment John Bellingham dies, his dead body has come into existence, and it is deposited for the time being wherever he happens to have died. But unless he should happen to have died in one of the places of burial mentioned, which is in the highest degree unlikely, his body will be, for the time being, deposited in some place other than those specified. In that case, clause 2 is, for the time being, not complied with, and consequently George Hearst becomes automatically the co-executor.
But will George Hearst carry out the provisions of clause 2?
Probably not. Why should he?
The will contains no instructions to that effect. It throws the whole duty on Godfrey. On the other hand, if he should carry out clause 2, what happens? He ceases to be an executor and he loses some £70,000. We may be pretty certain that he will do nothing of the kind.
So that on considering the two clauses, we see that the wishes of the testator could only be carried out in the unlikely event of his dying in one of the burial places mentioned, or his body being conveyed immediately after death to a public mortuary in one of the said parishes. In any other event, it is virtually certain that he will be buried in some place other than that which he desired, and that his brother will be left absolutely without provision or recognition.
John Bellingham could never have intended that, I said.
Clearly not, agreed Thorndyke. The provisions of the will furnish internal evidence that he did not.
You note that he bequeathed £5,000 to George Hearst in the event of Clause 2 being carried out, but he has made no bequest to his brother in the event of its not being carried out. Obviously, he had not entertained the possibility of this contingency at all. He assumed, as a matter of course, that the conditions of Clause 2 would be fulfilled, and regarded the conditions themselves as a mere formality.
But, Jervis objected, Jellicoe must have seen the danger of a miscarriage and pointed it out to his client.
Exactly, said Thorndyke. There is the mystery. We understand that he objected strenuously, and that John Bellingham was obdurate. Now it is perfectly understandable that a man should adhere obstinately to the most stupid and perverse disposition of his property, but that a man should persist in retaining a particular form of words after it has been proved to him that the use of such form will almost certainly result in the defeat of his own wishes,
That, I say, is a mystery that calls for very careful consideration.
If Jellicoe had been an interested party, said Jervis, one would have suspected him of lying low. But the form of Clause 2 doesn't affect him at all.
No, said Thorndyke, the person who stands to profit by the muddle is George Hurst. But we understand that he was unacquainted with the terms of the will, and there is certainly nothing to suggest that he is in any way responsible for it.
The practical question is, said I, what is going to happen, and what can be done for the Bellinghams?
The probability is, Thorndyke replied, that the next move will be made by Hurst. He is the party immediately interested. He will probably apply to the court for permission to presume death and administer the will.
And what will the court do?
Thorndyke smiled dryly.
Now you are asking a very pretty conundrum. The decisions of courts depend on idiosyncrasies of temperament that no one can foresee. But one might say that a court does not lightly grant permission to presume death. There will be a rigorous inquiry, and a decidedly unpleasant one, I suspect, and the evidence will be reviewed by the judge with a strong predisposition to regard the testator as being still alive. On the other hand, the known facts point very distinctly to the probability that he is dead, and if the will were less complicated and all the parties interested were unanimous in supporting the application, I don't see why it might not be granted.
But it will certainly be to the interests of Godfrey to oppose the application, unless he can show that the conditions of Clause 2 have been complied with, which it is virtually certain he cannot, and he may be able to bring forward reasons for believing John to be still alive. But even if he is unable to do this, inasmuch as it was pretty clear that he was intended to be the chief beneficiary, his opposition is likely to have considerable weight with the court.
"Oh, is it?" I exclaimed eagerly. "Then that accounts for a very peculiar proceeding on the part of Hurst. I have stupidly forgotten to tell you about it. He has been trying to come to a private agreement with Godfrey Bellingham."
"Indeed," said Thorndyke. "What sort of agreement?"
"His proposal was this, that Godfrey should support him and Jellicoe in an application to the court for permission to presume death and to administer the will, that if it was successful, Hurst should pay him £400 a year for life, the arrangement to hold good in all eventualities."
"By which he means?"
"That if the body should be discovered at any future time, so that the conditions of Clause 2 could be carried out, Hurst should still retain the property and continue to pay Godfrey the £400 a year for life."
"Hey-ho!" exclaimed Thorndyke. "That is a queer proposal, a very queer proposal indeed."
"Not to say fishy," added Jervis. "I don't fancy the court would look with approval on that little arrangement."
"The law does not look with much favor on any little arrangements that aim at getting behind the provisions of a will," Thorndyke replied, "though there would be nothing to complain of in this proposal if it were not for the reference to all eventualities. If a will is hopelessly impracticable, it is not unreasonable or improper for the various beneficiaries to make such private arrangements amongst themselves as may seem necessary to avoid useless litigation and delay in administering the will. If, for instance, Hurst had proposed to pay £400 a year to Godfrey so long as the body remained undiscovered on condition that, in the event of its discovery, Godfrey should pay him a like sum for life, there would have been nothing to comment upon. It would have been an ordinary sporting chance. But the reference to all eventualities is an entirely different matter. Of course, it may be mere greediness, but all the same it suggests some very curious reflections."
"Yes, it does," said Jervis. "I wonder if he has any reason to expect that the body will be found."
"Of course, it doesn't follow that he has. He may be merely taking the opportunity offered by the other man's poverty to make sure of the bulk of the property, whatever happens. But it is uncommonly sharp practice, to say the least."
"Do I understand that Godfrey declined the proposal?" Thorndyke asked.
"Yes, he did, very emphatically, and I fancy the two gentlemen proceeded to exchange opinions on the circumstances of the disappearance with more frankness than delicacy."
"Ah," said Thorndyke, "that is a pity. If the case comes into court, there is bound to be a good deal of unpleasant discussion, and still more unpleasant comment in the newspapers. But if the parties themselves begin to express suspicions of one another, there is no telling where the matter will end."
"No, by Jove," said Jervis. "If they begin flinging accusations of murder about, The fat will be in the fire with a vengeance. That way lies the Old Bailey.
We must try to prevent them from making an unnecessary scandal, said Thorndyke. It may be that an exposure will be unavoidable, and that must be ascertained in advance. But to return to your question, Berkeley, as to what is to be done. Hearst will probably make some move pretty soon. Do you know if Jellicoe will act with him?
No, he won't. He declines to take any steps without Godfrey's assent. At least that is what he says at present. His attitude is one of correct neutrality.
That is satisfactory so far, said Thorndyke, though he may alter his tone when the case comes into court.
From what you said just now, I gathered that Jellicoe would prefer to have the will administered and be quit of the whole business, which is natural enough, especially as he benefits under the will to the extent of £2,000 and a valuable collection. Consequently, we may fairly assume that, even if he maintains an apparent neutrality, his influence will be exerted in favor of Hearst rather than of Bellingham, from which it follows that Bellingham ought certainly to be properly advised, and when the case goes into court, properly represented.
He can't afford either one or the other, said I. He's as poor as an insolvent church mouse and as proud as the devil. He wouldn't accept professional aid that he couldn't pay for.
Grunted Thorndyke, that's awkward. But we can't allow the case to go by default, so to speak, to fail for the mere lack of technical assistance. Besides, it is one of the most interesting cases that I have ever met with, and I am not going to see it bungled.
He couldn't object to a little general advice in a friendly, informal way, amicus curiae, as old Broadrib is so fond of saying, and there is nothing to prevent us from pushing forward with the preliminary inquiries.
Of what nature would they be?
Well, to begin with, we have to satisfy ourselves that the conditions of Clause 2 have not been complied with, that John Bellingham has not been buried within the parish boundaries mentioned. Of course he has not, but we must not take anything for granted. Then we have to satisfy ourselves that he is not still alive and accessible. It is perfectly possible that he is, after all, and it is our business to trace him, if he is still in the land of the living.
Jervis and I can carry out these investigations without saying anything to Bellingham. My learned brother will look through the registers of burials, not forgetting the cremations, in the metropolitan area, and I will take the other matter in hand.
You really think that John Bellingham may still be alive, said I?
Since his body has not been found, it is obviously a possibility.
I think it in the highest degree improbable, but the improbable has to be investigated before it can be excluded.
It sounds a rather hopeless quest, I remarked. How do you propose to begin?
I think of beginning at the British Museum. The people there might be able to throw some light on his movements. I know that there are some important excavations in progress at Heliopolis. In fact, the director of the Egyptian department is out there at the present moment, and Dr. Norbury, who is taking his place temporarily, is an old friend of Bellingham's. I shall call on him and try to discover if there is anything that might have induced Bellingham suddenly to go abroad to Heliopolis, for instance. Also, he may be able to tell me what it was that took the missing man to Paris on that last, rather mysterious journey. That might turn out to be an important clue. And meanwhile, Berkeley, you must endeavor tactfully to reconcile your friend to the idea of letting us give an eye to the case. Make it clear to him that I am doing this entirely from the enlargement of my own knowledge.
But won't you have to be instructed by a solicitor? I asked.
Yes, nominally, but only as a matter of etiquette. We shall do all the actual work. Why do you ask?
I was thinking of the solicitor's costs, and I was going to mention that I have a little money of my own.
Then you keep it, my dear fellow. You'll want it when you go into practice. There will be no difficulty about the solicitor. I shall ask one of my friends to act nominally as a personal favor to me. Marchmont would take the case for us, Jervis, I am sure.
Yes, said Jervis, or old Broadrib, if we can put him to amicus curiae.
It is excessively kind of both of you to take this benevolent interest in the case of my friends, I said, and it is to be hoped that they won't be foolishly proud and stiff-necked about it. It's rather the way with poor gentlefolk.
I'll tell you what, exclaimed Jervis. I have a most brilliant idea. You shall give us a little supper at your rooms and invite the Bellinghams to meet us. Then you and I will attack the old gentleman, and Thorndyke shall exercise his persuasive powers on the lady. These chronic, incurable old bachelors, you know, are quite irresistible.
You observe that my respected junior condemns me to lifelong celibacy, Thorndyke remarked.
But, he added, his suggestion is quite a good one. Of course, we mustn't put any sort of pressure on Bellingham to employ us, for that is what it amounts to, even if we accept no payment. But a friendly talk over the supper table would enable us to put the matter delicately and yet convincingly.
Yes, said I see that, and I like the idea immensely. But it won't be possible for several days, because I've got a job that takes up all my spare time. And that I ought to be at work on now, I added, with a sudden qualm at the way in which I had forgotten the passage of time in the interests of Thorndyke's analysis. My two friends looked at me inquiringly, and I felt it necessary to explain about the injured hand and the Tel el Marna tablets, which I accordingly did rather shyly and with a nervous eye upon Jervis. The slow grin, however, for which I was watching never came. On the contrary, he not only heard me through quite gravely, but when I had finished, said with some warmth and using my old hospital pet name, "I'll say one thing for you, Polly. You're a good chum, and you always were. I hope your Neville's Court friends appreciate the fact."
"They are far more appreciative than the occasion warrants," I answered.
"But to return to this question, how will this day week suit you?"
"It will suit me," Thorndyke answered, with a glance at his junior.
"And me too," said the latter. "So if it will do for the Bellinghams, we will consider it settled. But if they can't come, you must fix another night."
"Very well," I said, rising and knocking out my pipe. "I will issue the invitation tomorrow. And now I must be off to have another slog at those notes."
As I walked homeward, I speculated cheerfully on the prospect of my entertaining my friends under my own, or rather Barnard's, roof, if they could be lured out of their eremitical retirement. The idea had, in fact, occurred to me already, but I had been deterred by the peculiarities of Barnard's housekeeper. For Mrs. Gummer was one of those housewives who make up for an archaic simplicity of production by preparations on the most portentous and alarming scale. But this time I would not be deterred. If only the guests could be enticed into my humble lair, it would be easy to furnish the raw materials of the feast from outside, and the consideration of ways and means occupied me pleasantly until I found myself once more at my writing-table, confronted by my voluminous notes on the incidents of the North Syrian War. End of chapter 7.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.